Good thing we were here, Paul said. And Josie realized the truth of it. If they hadn't come to town, if she hadn't made her attempts at music in Cooper's home, they would have been at the mine that day. Alone, without a soul knowing they were there.
Everyone ready?
The driver asked. The bus sputtered awake and pointed itself north.
Are you done with that? Paul asked.
Josie looked over to him. He'd moved himself to the next seat over like some independent fellow traveler. Anna was lying on the floor, gnawing on Josie's leg, waiting to be told to stop.
With the music? Josie asked,
and Paul closed his eyes. Of course the music, his placid face said. Wasn't she on the verge of some great discovery? If not one meant for the world, at least a private revelation, bringing forth the music within her? Josie watched the scenery pass, the fire trucks heading the other way, toward the trouble, and she realized, with some surprise, that the music she needed to hear, that she'd just heard, that she'd brought forth, had swum in, she needed no more of it. Not right now, at least. Cooper would not understand this. You're on to something, he might say. Or would he say that? She was probably not on to something. She was more likely a woman temporarily insane who had been conjuring dissonant madness from a group of pliable musicians wanting free dental care. But what about staying in that town, Cooper's town, and weaving herself into it, becoming their new dentist, their resident eccentric, amateur composer, part of the musician's world, raising her children there? No, or not yet. She was free of it. She was free of so many things. The fear of Carl, the ghost of Evelyn. She would not ever feel free of Jeremy, but 2 out of 3 was a start. She was no longer fleeing anything, but that didn't mean she wanted to be kept, handled, cared for. I don't know, she told Paul. She could not promise that she would not do it again. She had no idea. She needed no more music, but needed to do something else and to see something else, and she needed to make her children braver and stronger by moving. She could make no promises about what she would want to do or see in the future, and she hoped her children would forgive her for this lack of certainty, this never-settled question in their lives, a limitless sky that had the power to make them fearless, utterly indomitable, or cripple them with fear. They drove for hours, over streams and through wide expanses of taiga, the sky ahead a velvet blue. Cooper had said he would meet Josie and her kids, and as the scenery passed, she became unsure this was something she wanted. She was not sure she could trust her state of mind, but after 20 minutes of riding away, she felt a familiar exhilaration, the breathless freedom of having left trouble behind. It was not unlike the feeling she'd had when she left Ohio and when they'd landed in Alaska. Now the chateau was gone, the cabin was gone, they were free from everything again. They knew no one on the bus and were headed to a place where they knew not a soul. By the time they pulled into a wide parking lot, loud with police lights and emergency vehicles, Anna was asleep on Josie's lap, and Paul had moved to another seat, 2 rows up. This was new. Until even just a few weeks ago, he never would have ceded the position of human pillow. He certainly wouldn't be so far away from the sleeping Anna when, at any moment, she might need his help. Now, though, he was looking out the window, taking in the bright parking lot scene, the police lights, the dozens of volunteers in orange and yellow rushing to and fro.
Inside the school there, the driver said.
Josie woke up Anna, and she led her and Paul off the bus. Paul was carrying one of the backpacks, and Josie had the other. The school was a low-slung brick building, the front double doors opened wide, a woman sitting at a folding table inside.
Hi there, the woman said, her voice quiet and kind, as if she knew of the sleeping horror inside of them and didn't want to wake it.
Josie gave the woman their names, and the woman directed them into the gym, where enormous lights illuminated in discrete sections every service available: first aid, bedding, food. At the window where the high school normally served lunch, a variety of fresh food was being spooned onto plates. Half the gym was a grid of cots that had been neatly arranged, though most were empty. A computer-printed sign advertised the services of a registered nurse. She stood by the sign, a young man lying on a cot next to her, with no discernible injuries. He was leaning over the side, reading a comic book. On the gym's stage, a trio of kids, all under six, chased a fourth child, a yellow-haired girl wearing a cape.
"Are you sheltering here tonight?"
a voice asked. Josie turned to find a man in all black, a priest or pastor.
"I don't know. I guess so," she said.
Josie and Paul and Anna devoured spaghetti and broccoli, watermelon and chocolate cake. They hadn't eaten, she realized, most of the day.
"Are we going to school, Hugh?"
Anna asked, her teeth brown with frosting. Paul smiled and shook his head.
"No, sweetie," Josie said. "We're just staying here a night or two."
But she had no idea what they would do next. She listened to snippets of conversations between the volunteers in the gym. Most of the evacuees in the gym were from Morristown or other nearby towns. Only a few outbuildings had burned there so far, she learned. An army of firefighters were working valiantly, aided by a favorable wind that had slowed the progress of the burn. When she brought their finished plates back to the cafeteria window, Josie noticed that a woman in a black uniform, a kind of fire information officer, had just pinned up a new map of the scope of the burn. Josie scanned it for Morristown and found it, an almost imperceptible rectangle just next to a hulking red mass, the area of the fire, the color and shape of an oversized heart. On the border between the red and white, she found in tiny type the words Peterson Mine, nearly obscured by an X written in red ballpoint. Josie returned to the trio of cots she and the kids had arranged. They had pushed them together to make one loosely connected mattress. Paul and Anna were playing Go Fish with a new deck of cards.
"Someone gave us these," Paul explained.
Josie sat on the edge of the bed, then dropped to the pillow. She looked to the ceiling, 30 feet up, a mess of ropes and beams and banners reminding visitors of the school's better seasons. At 9 o'clock, most of the gym's lights went off with a loud crack and sigh, leaving one bright cone in each corner. Anna wanted to continue to play cards, but Paul told her they should be quiet and still so as not to disturb the rest of the people trying to sleep.
"You guys have everything you need?" a voice asked.
Josie looked up and squinted, adjusting her eyes to the dark. It was a man, an older man with a sweep of gray hair across his eyes. He looked familiar. Josie thought of home, someone from Ohio. No. Then she realized it was the firefighter she'd met before. It seemed like months ago, the gentle-eyed man who had come upon her when the inmates had changed her tire.
"We do," she told him, and realized he didn't recognize her. Why he was here, checking up on evacuees, was unclear.
She didn't want to distract him from his work or get into a conversation about just what she'd been doing then on that road or what she was doing now, hundreds of miles north in this shelter. She wouldn't be able to explain it if she tried.
"Rain's coming."
These were the first words Josie heard in the morning. It was dawn, and already the gym was bustling with volunteers loudly preparing breakfast.
"This afternoon," the voice said.
It was coming from outside the gym, this booming voice with this significant news. Anna had woken up with the noise, but Paul slept on. Josie led Anna silently off the mattress and into the lobby, looking for the booming voice, but he had disappeared. Still, throughout the school hallways, there was talk that the worst had come and gone, that the weeks ahead would bring more rain, more cold, a wet autumn that would end the fires and purify. They walked outside to find the sky was still the same, white and yellow and smelling acrid. Josie stepped farther into the parking lot and now saw, coming from the north, a wall of dark clouds. Back inside, Josie peeked into the gym to see if Paul was awake, but he was still splayed on the bed, his mouth open, as if astonished by rest. When she turned around, Anna was not at her side. Josie looked through the lobby and heard some small voices coming from another hallway. She turned the corner to find Anna at the drinking fountain with another child, this one smaller. At first glance, it looked like Anna was being Anna, pouring water from the fountain onto the head of this other child, a tow-headed boy of about 4. Josie was about to tell Anna to stop when she realized that Anna was feeding water to the child. Anna had directed the child to turn the faucet on, and while the water flowed, Anna reached up, her tiny hands making a tiny bowl, and she was bringing this water to the child, most of it landing on their shirts, but enough finding its way to the blonde child's mouth. Josie walked to them, and Anna looked up at her, worried, knowing she would need to explain. "It's okay," Josie said. "He couldn't reach," Anna said. "I know, it's fine. Let's clean up, though." And so the three of them found paper towels in the bathroom and cleaned the water from the floor. The boy's mother arrived as they were finishing and took the boy back to the gym. Josie and Anna stood in front in the hallway, next to the school's darkened trophy case.
"Do we have to sleep you again?" Anna asked.
Josie didn't know.
"I don't want to," Anna said.
"I don't either," Josie said, realizing this was the first candid conversation she'd had with Anna in months, maybe ever. Usually, she was strategizing how to tell Anna something, avoid telling her something, parsing and obfuscating in order to get a civilized result. Now she looked into Anna's eyes, knowing that her daughter was different. She had evolved, and she saw, too, that Anna knew. She knew that she had shed one shape and was taking on another. "We only have $88, Josie said, looking not at Anna now, but at a portrait of some champion athlete from the early 90s, a girl who was probably now Josie's age.
88? Anna said. "That's a lot."
Paul slept through a loud breakfast and through the activation of the loudspeakers above, which announced a series of developments, the imminent arrival of other evacuees, and more news about the rain coming from the north. When he finally woke, there was a smattering of applause from the volunteers. A grandmotherly woman brought him a bowl of homemade oatmeal, which she ate greedily as she watched. "Well, you're safe now," she said to Josie and her kids, as if concluding a conversation about their prior worries. "And at noon, we're having an activity for all the evacuees. All the families will be invited to participate in a crafting workshop, and afterward to talk about their feelings. It'll be very therapeutic, but fun, too." Josie smiled, and the woman left to pick up the bowls left in various parts of the gym by the dozen or so children now running roughshod through it. The gym had gotten more crowded in the last hour, it seemed, and smelled of too many humans without access to showers, too many humans sleeping in old clothes in close proximity. Staying here another hour suddenly seemed painful, another night altogether impossible. Josie tidied up their beds and took their two backpacks and led Paul and Anna out of the school. She had no plan in mind, but wanted to see what options there were in town. $88 would buy them one day of lodging and food at a real motel. Now a woman was approaching.
"Ma'am, I forgot to ask before."
Josie couldn't place if she'd ever met this woman, but had to assume she had.
"Whether or not you have access to a phone. So many evacuees either leave theirs behind or can't get coverage, but we have landlines here. You can call long distance, whatever."
Josie told the woman she didn't, in fact, have phone access,
and she and Anna were led to the principal's office in the school. On the counter where tardy slips were usually handed out, there was a phone at the ready.
"I'll give you some privacy," the woman said.
Josie dialed, got a wrong number, and dialed again. He answered.
"Carl?"
"Who is this?"
"It's Josie."
"Oh, hey, where are you? How are the kids?"
His voice was upbeat, casual. "You don't know where we are?"
"I know you're in Alaska, Sam told me, but where?"
"You do know. You sent a guy after me."
"Wait, what?"
"Didn't you serve me papers?" she asked.
"Serve you papers? What for?"
His voice was so bright and amused that she had to realign everything she expected to say. "Someone served me papers," she said, her mind racing through just who it could have been. "Evelyn?"
"What kind of papers?"
Carl asked. "I don't know. I never touched them. I took off." Carl laughed out loud. It was a big belly laugh, the laugh of a contented man. Josie heard a distant squeal through the line, the sound of a gentle crashing wave. Was he on a beach? He probably was on a beach.
"Oh, wait, your lawyer buddy called me looking for you,"
he said.
"Maybe that could have something to do with it."
"Elias? What did he say?"
"He said he wanted to give you a heads up. I called you a few times about it. You probably didn't bring your phone. Am I right?"
"I didn't want you tracking me." Again, Carl laughed, but this time there was something hurt and uncertain in his mirth.
"Anyway, remember the power company you sued? Well, they countersued all the lead plaintiffs. Elias said it was a standard scare tactic, said he'd handle it."
Josie's heart spun. She hadn't thought of that lawsuit in weeks.
"So the kids, they're good?"
Carl asked, switching back to a tone of brightness and levity. Was he drunk, too? Who was this happy, carefree man? "They're good. Sorry about Florida," she said.
"It's okay. I understand. It probably sounded like a weird request. But the kids should meet Teresa at some point. They'll like her, I think. She's a child psychologist. You know that?"
Josie did not know that, but now her interest in Carl made sense.
"So you guys are in Alaska?"
Carl let out a loud exhalation that admitted his own foibles and forgave Josie's dramatics. She was still squaring all this. Carl had not gone after her in any way. He was not following her, suing her, nothing. Instead, it was a power company. They'd sent some random server to scare her.
"From the news, it looks like the whole state is on fire," Carl said.
"We actually just fled one," Josie said. "We're in a shelter." She recounted the day, the school she was calling from. She looked around her, remembering she was in a principal's office. A sign on the wall said, "I'm a principal. What's your superpower?"
"And you're okay?"
he asked. "We're fine."
"Okay, stay safe. Give a shout when you get back."
She hung up and left the office, realizing Carl hadn't asked to speak to the kids. He hadn't asked when they were coming home. Even the idea of seeing his children, bringing them to Florida to present them to Teresa and her family, that Goebbelsian photo op was a casual notion, not a big deal either way. His interest in them came and went, like his passion for economic equality or triathlons. But he was harmless. This was so crucial and freeing to know.
"Let's get out a little," Josie said.
She was standing over the cot where Paul and Anna were playing cards.
"Go where?" Anna asked.
Josie shrugged. "The river?" This town was about the size of Cooper's, and they meandered through it, noticing that it was largely empty. Most of the residents were either helping at the high school, Josie figured, or had left the state for less flammable lands. They passed a truck repair operation, a real estate office, a frame shop, all closed, and found themselves at the Yukon, gray and moving slowly. They sat down, Josie suddenly feeling too tired to move. She lay back, staring into the white sky, and could feel the sun beyond it, still oddly warm.
"This one's heavy," Paul said, and a loud thunk followed.
Her children, stripped of all possessions, were throwing stones into the river. The clicking as they sifted for the right one, an almost imperceptible wind as they threw the stone high, the bass note as each hit the water.
"You want me to put one on your foot? It's hot from the sun."
It was Anna, standing above her.
"Okay,"
Josie said, her eyes closed. She felt the hot weight of a large rock placed on her instep. It felt wonderful. She murmured her approval.
"You want another?"
Anna asked, and Josie said she did. Anna placed another rock, a lighter one, on Josie's stomach, and Josie felt the heat of it through her shirt. Choosing to keep her eyes closed, she allowed Anna, and soon Paul, to cover her with stones. There were a dozen on her chest and stomach, and a key few in her lap, feeling very right, and finally, a large flat stone on her forehead, smaller, rounder stones covering each cheek. The warmth of these stones. It slowed her breathing. She couldn't move. Covered like this, minutes were days, and she heard the voices of her children as they tried to find more places to cover their mother, their voices delighted, though nervous at the edges. What were they seeing? Their mother covered in stones, so far from home. Josie allowed herself a moment of doubt. There was a possibility, she admitted, that she and her children should not have come to this state on fire. But the doubt did not last. Instead, at this moment, she thought she was right about everything. That we can leave. That we have a right to leave. That very often we must leave. That only having left could she and her children achieve something like sublimity. That without movement, there is no struggle. And without struggle, there is no purpose. And without purpose, there is nothing at all. She wanted to tell every mother, every father, there is meaning in motion. As the sun finger-painted lurid colors on her eyelids, Josie felt a surge of belonging. She had love for everyone. She knew it wouldn't last, this outpouring of gratitude and forgiveness, so she named names. She loved Jeremy and Sam and Raj and Dina and Charlie from the cruise ship and Grenaded Jim and Carl, of course Sunny, and had something like love for Evelyn, whose dying filled her with rage, and Josie knew rage, and so she loved Evelyn. With a shudder, she knew she loved her parents, too, and that she wanted to tell them this, and felt she must tell them this, that it was time to tell them that she knew them to be no better and no worse than herself.
"We're taking them off now," Paul said.
There was a tone of finality in his voice, hinting at his growing discomfort with his mother covered in stones. When Josie's chest was free from the weight, she sat up, and her children looked at her quizzically, as if they expected her to have become someone else. But she was only their mother, sitting up in the bright sun. They continued to remove the stones from her lap and legs.
"How heavy do you think this is?" Paul asked.
He put one of the rocks in her hand. It was warm.
"Was that on my chest?" she asked.
"Yes," he said.
"Maybe a pound?" she said.
Paul made a disappointed sound.
"Maybe 2-3 pounds, she tried.
His face brightened slightly, but then soured again as he stared at the rock.
10 pounds, easily, she said. 10 pounds, Paul said to Anna, who was duly impressed.
Anna removed a rock from Josie's thigh and put it in her hand.
"How much is this?"
This one was lighter than Paul's, and Paul knew this, but he and Josie exchanged a look.
"This one's about the same," she said. 10 pounds, maybe more."
Anna's eyes sparkled, and Josie assumed Anna would keep the rock in some coveted place, but instead, Anna turned and threw it into the river in a reckless diagonal.
"See ya, sucko," she roared.
They continued to remove the stones, and each time they asked Josie how much she thought each weighed before dispatching that stone into the river. Anna threw hers with cruel send-offs, usually repeating Josie's measurements before casting them at violent trajectories. Each time a stone was removed, Josie felt closer to levitation. They were just stones, and she was only sitting by a lake shushing the jagged shore. But each time her children lifted one, she let out a tiny gasp, and her body felt closer to release. "Look, Mom," Anna said, and finally Josie stood up. Anna was pointing to a spot in the woods behind them. It seemed to be a simple trailhead sign, a standing map, but on it were colorful sagging orbs.
"Balloons," Anna said, and ran to the sign.
"Trailhead," Paul said, following her. The sign, decades old, depicted a path that wound through a valley, along a narrow river, on a steady upward trajectory until it reached a mountain lake. If there had ever been any indication of distance or scale on the map, it had been worn away by weather, but Josie figured it couldn't be more than a mile or two, and the elevation no more than 3,000 feet. "I've always wanted to see a mountain lake," she said.
"Me too," Paul said, staring with great seriousness at the map.
Paul had never said anything to Josie about a mountain lake, about knowing what one was or wanting to see one, but Paul did not, could not lie, and Josie had no choice but to believe that this, along with his knowing he could marry a girl named Helena, was a secret and real desire, and that from him there would be far more unspoken wants and needs in the future, and that she would be privy to so few of them, and she would have to accept this.
"So should we go?" he asked.
"What's a mountain lake?" Anna asked.
Chapter 23. They had one apple, a bag of unpeeled carrots, a bottle of orange Gatorade, a bag of crackers, half a pack of Starburst candy, and a bottle of water, two-thirds full. The kids were wearing jeans and t-shirts. The temperature was in the 60s. Josie felt good about their chances to make it to the lake and back to town in time for lunch. "Paul," she said, knowing she was about to delight him, "can you make a copy of that map?" His eyes took on the spark of duty as she handed him a pen and from her wallet, the back of a grocery store receipt. His rendering was clear enough and included most of the information on the sign's map, which is to say, not a great deal. There was a long, winding trail and an oval lake, and next to it, a tiny rectangle, which Josie assumed was some kind of picnic area, maybe a shelter of some kind. It looked less like a modern Forest Service map and more like the sort of thing an illiterate bandit would have drawn while drunk on hard cider. But when they got to the trail, Josie saw that it was wide and well-marked, and for all she knew, there were souvenirs and snack shops along the way. They began. They walked into a copse of birches spaced in an orderly fashion, the light on the forest floor dappled and the air cool. Ahead, they saw a yellow stripe the size of a hand on the trunk of a tree, and Josie laughed, knowing this trail would be easy. Someone had marked it every 100 yards. They looked at Paul's map, and it told them nothing new. The lake was up ahead, still seeming no more than an hour's walk.
"A bridge," Paul said, and pointed to where a log, halved lengthwise, had been laid across a tiny ravine leading to the river.
Covering a narrow creek of shallow water moving slowly, the bridge was rudimentary and slick with moss, but Paul and Anna insisted on walking across it without her help. It was only a few feet down, so even if they fell in, they couldn't possibly be hurt. Josie allowed them to cross, and then they wanted to do it again, so they went back and did it again. They walked along the river for a time, an hour or more, the heat of the day peaking, Paul and Anna starting to wilt, and then the path turned inward and toward the hills, and they walked in shadow. Ahead, the path seemed to run directly into a boulder the size of an ancient barn. They followed the path all the way to the boulder, which, up close, looked more like a granite wall. They looked left and right and saw no yellow markers. I think we're supposed to go through it, Paul said. He seemed utterly serious until a tiny smirk overtook the left side of his mouth.
Look, yellow, Anna said.
Josie and Paul turned to see that Anna had found a tiny yellow stripe on a tree high on the hill overlooking the river. There was a narrow thread of trail leading up to and around the boulder, and they took it, all three of them, Josie and Paul and Anna, having the distinct sense that without Anna they would not have seen what now seemed like an obvious path upward and over. In half an hour they climbed the path, using tree roots for footing, until they'd reached the top and they could see a clearing ahead.
Might be the lake, Paul said.
Josie looked at her watch. It was just after noon. If they were indeed at the lake, even if they made it there, turned around and walked quickly, they'd be back in town by 2. They reached the top of that ridge, but there was no lake, only remnants of, or the origins of, a shallow stream pooling. Around them was a wide meadow dotted with wildflowers of violet and yellow.
Is that the lake? Anna asked.
It's not the lake, Paul said, then turned to Josie.
Is it?
No, Josie said. This was the kind of setting, tucked into the curve of a mountain, where she expected to find it. And now they had walked so far and climbed over the ridge and found something else, some swampy stream. It was a cruel thing. Okay, she said. Let's think. And she contemplated the time and their place on this trail, halfway up a mountain far larger than she'd imagined. It had taken them hours to get this far. There was time to go farther, reach the lake, and turn back, she thought, though she had the tangible sensation she was making the wrong decision. She was afraid to look at Paul, for fear his eyes would judge her. Anna pointed to the sky.
Look, Mom, she said.
A great dark cloud had come from behind the mountain. The moment they saw it, they heard thunder. It was a loud clearing of the throat that filled the valley, an introduction to calamity.
Is that coming toward us? Paul asked.
Will there be lightning?
Anna asked. The thunder came again, this time louder. Josie looked up to find that the cloud had moved closer, casting half the mountainside in grim shadow, and they were standing near the shallow stream.
I don't know, Josie said.
Realizing they were standing by a stream, she tried to remember the workings of lightning and water. Was the water a conductor or a deterrent? There seemed to be no good choices around her. Lightning was coming, likely rain too. If they stayed out in the open, they would get soaked.
Should we go there?
Anna asked, pointing to a forest ahead. It seemed to be about an eighth of a mile across the upward sloping meadow, a distance not daunting. But then again, all distances so far had been warped. Everything that had seemed within reach was in fact twice as far and took 3 times as long.
The lightning goes after the trees, right?
Paul asked. I don't know, Josie said.
How could she not know? Stay away from water or go toward water? Into the trees or away from the trees?
Then again, they hadn't seen lightning yet. So she held out hope that they could make it to the forest before the real storm came, if it came at all. The forest seemed the safest option. They could rest there, stay dry.
Let's run, Josie said.
Paul and Anna's eyes spoke of their exhaustion, but this was quickly replaced by the spark of a necessary task.
We're going to run to that bunch of trees, okay?
Josie said. They nodded. Anna positioned herself in a sprinter's start.
Ready?
Josie asked.
Let's go.
They took off, away from the water and across the flowered meadow, not caring what colors they crushed underfoot.
Yes!
Anna roared behind her. Josie turned and saw Anna's tiny feet fly over rocks and bramble, her big orange head leaping like a candle carried by a rabbit. She watched Paul's face, set with purpose. The trees were only a few hundred yards away now. They would make it. When they were near the first great pines, Josie felt silly, having made this more dramatic than it needed to be. After all, they were simply outside, running in a developing storm. She didn't want her children to be afraid of the rain or the thunder or lightning, even if, given their altitude, the storm might be coming from a perilously close distance. Before the forest, there was an array of small, jagged boulders, and among them, Josie stopped, allowing Paul and Anna to pass her, smiling as she watched them fly by her, pumping their arms, both of them grinning wildly.
"Good, good!" Josie roared, almost jubilant.
A screaming crack ripped open the sky above. The world went white, and Josie's back seized as if whipped. In front of her, Paul and Anna were frozen in the white light for a few long seconds, photographed in mid-stride. She had the momentary thought that they had been struck, that this was what it was to be struck by lightning, that her children were being eliminated from the world. But the light turned off, and the world returned to color, and her children continued moving, continued living, and the flash was followed by a thunderclap so loud she stopped and threw herself to the ground.
"Get down," she yelled to Paul and Anna, "and come here."
Paul and Anna crawled to her, and she draped herself over the two of them. They stayed low for a minute as the sky growled and panted as if impatiently looking for Josie and her children.
"I'm scared," Anna said. "Will the lightning hit us?"
"No," Paul said firmly.
"Not while we're low like this. Make yourself small," he said.
And Anna shrunk, holding her knees with her arms.
"Good,"
he said. "Okay, we're going to run again," Josie said. "Just to the trees." She looked up, seeing they were no more than 100 yards away from the next forest. "Ready?" she asked. Paul and Anna nodded, ready to push off and run. Josie paused a moment longer than she had planned, and she had no reason why. For a fleeting moment, she looked into the forest and ran her eyes up the length of the tallest tree, wondering briefly if it was true that the lightning would strike the tallest object in the field.
"Are we going?"
Paul asked. And then the world tore open. A sickening light filled the forest, and a blue-white bolt split the tree, the one she'd just been contemplating, a quick axe driven down its spine.
"Shit,"
Josie said.
"Mom, will it get us now?"
Anna asked. Josie said no, it wouldn't get them. That last strike was the closest the lightning would come, she told them, though she had no reason to believe this was true. If anything, the lightning was getting closer each time. It seemed to be acting with intent. They waited, watching the charred remains of the split tree smolder, a narrow plume of gray smoke spreading upward. The thunder roared again, sounding like a tank moving across the roof of the sky. Josie ran all available options through her mind. They could stay where they were, but they'd get soaked. The rain would come soon, she was sure, and the sun would set, and the dark would be absolute. They would be wet and cold and unable to find their way back. They had to continue now. She could see the trail winding up the next mile or so, interrupted by small stands of trees. They would have to sprint between them, between lightning strikes. "We're going to that next forest," she told her children. "It's just a few 100 yards. But the path there was wide open, unprotected, and while they ran across the expanse, they would be easy targets for whatever malevolent force was patrolling their progress.
"No, Mama," Anna said. "No, please."
Paul explained that the lightning had just struck the trees, so why would they go where the lightning had just struck? "It won't strike there again," she said, not believing herself. "And it's going to rain soon, okay? We have to move." She had some irrational hope that there was something, some human structure, even a discarded tent at the lake. "One, two, three," she said, and they ran again, their shoulders hunched, their heads fearing reprisal from above. The first raindrops fell on their sprinting forms as they found the shelter of the trees. They passed the tree that had been struck, smelling its charred wood, the scent strangely clean, and continued until the forest thickened, dark with low boughs. Josie stopped, and Paul and Anna gathered around her, and the three of them, out of breath, sat down against the wide trunk of an ancient pine.
Can't we just stay here?
Anna asked, and Josie thought it very possible they could stay there, at least for a spell, in hopes the storm might pass. As she was contemplating this, though, the rain came heavier, and a gust of cold wind shot through the trees. The temperature seemed to drop 20 degrees, and the rain drenched them in seconds. She looked down at Anna, who was wearing a short-sleeved shirt. Her eyes were wide, and her teeth began chattering. No, Josie thought. No, only one option. She took off her own shirt. Let me put this on you, she told Anna, and Anna gave her a horrified look. Put it on, Josie said firmly. Anna threw the shirt over her head, and it draped awkwardly over her torso and rested across her knees.
You're going in just that?
Paul asked, nodding toward Josie's white bra, a utilitarian style with a tiny fringe of lace. I'm fine, Josie said, mistaking his statement for one of concern. He was embarrassed for her, she realized. He didn't want his mother running across a mountain trail in a bra. Let me see that map, Josie said, asking Paul for the hand-drawn rendering he'd made when they'd begun. Josie wasn't sure what she expected to find on it, but she had begun to think their forward push was ill-advised. They were heading further into the storm, into territory they knew nothing about, but if they turned back, no matter how long it took or how wet and cold they got, they could be sure to find the town. Paul hesitated for a moment, then a grave look overtook his face. He pulled the paper from his pocket, unfolded it, and hovered over it, protecting it from the rain. Above, two jets collided. There could be no other explanation. Josie had never heard thunder so loud. The raindrops grew still bigger. Her children, already soaked, somehow grew wetter, colder. Josie estimated the temperature was in the high 50s and would drop 10 degrees in the next hour. Now she looked at the map, and though it was as rudimentary as the one he'd copied it from, showing only a meandering trail leading to an oval lake, there was that tidy rectangle next to the oval. It had to be some kind of structure, she thought. Even an outhouse would be life-saving. You're sure about this? She asked, pointing to his drawing.
What? Paul said. That? It was on the original map.
Okay, she said. You're sure?
I'm sure, he said.
She knew her son would have taken the task of map drawing with the utmost seriousness, and now, if he was right, the box on the hand-drawn map might save them. It was far closer than going back to the trailhead, miles closer. It was just around a wide bend in the trail. You guys rested? She asked. Neither child answered. We have to run again, she said. We have to run until we get to the lake and the shelter. Do you understand? We'll go in stages. We'll run from point to point, and we'll rest when we need to rest, okay? Above, a planet popped like a balloon. Can you guys be brave? Josie asked. Paul and Anna didn't hesitate. They nodded vigorously, wanting to be brave, knowing there was no choice but to be brave, that there was nothing greater than being brave. Josie knew then that better than searching for a person of courage, she'd been on this search for years, dear God, better and possibly easier than searching for such people in the extant world was to create them. She didn't need to find humans of integrity and courage. She needed to make them. A private smile had overtaken Anna's face. What? Josie asked.
I can't say it, Anna said.
Say it, doesn't matter.
It's a bad word, I think, Anna said.
It's okay.
Shitstorm, Anna said,
and Paul laughed, his ice priest eyes smiling, lit from within. It is a shitstorm, Josie said. This is a shitstorm. Are you ready to run through this shitstorm? They grinned and took off again. They ran through the stand of trees, and when the trees ended and the trail was exposed for another 100 yards, they saw another yellow marker and scrambled to it. The rocks on the path were wet now, and Anna slipped on one and went down, gashing her leg against the scree. Lightning lit up the world in slashing blue light, but Josie didn't pause. She picked up Anna in mid-stride and carried her chest to chest until they reached the next small forest. By the time she was able to put Anna down, Josie's back had shifted. Something was very wrong. She couldn't breathe. She set Anna down and lay on her side, trying to find a workable way to bring air into her body. A slipped disc, a punctured lung, broken rib, anything was possible.
"What happened?" Paul asked.
Josie couldn't speak. She raised a finger to ask for time. Now both children were staring at her, Anna with her mother's wet shirt draped over her like a smock. Josie looked up into the treetops, the black fur silhouettes against the sky, angry and gray like an ocean storm. Josie slowly regained her breath, and when she was able to sit up again, she found that Paul had torn a strip from the bottom of her shirt, the shirt now worn by Anna, and had used the strip to tie Anna's leg with a makeshift bandage. It looked like something you'd find on a World War I battlefield, but Anna was caressing it, humbled by its grandeur. An oval of blood emerged from within, and Anna's eyes widened. Josie looked up the trail and thought she could see, just beyond one more stripe of trees and over a low ridge, the clearing where the lake and shelter might be. She stood, very much afraid she might not have the strength, or that the act of standing would make whatever had happened to her far worse. Though she was wrecked and now noticed that her legs were bleeding in a dozen places, she could breathe and was reasonably sure she could run again.
"She can't run," Paul said, indicating Anna.
"Is that true?" Josie asked her. Anna's eyes welled up and her chin quivered. Josie looked down to see that Anna couldn't put weight on her right foot. Josie examined the leg up and down and found no fracture, but when she put the lightest pressure on the bandage, Anna wailed.
"You twisted it. Nothing broken," Josie said. And now Anna's eyes flooded.
"Okay, wrap yourself around me," Josie told her. "Like a monkey." Anna threw her arms around her, burying her tiny shoulder in Josie's neck. When Josie stood again, now carrying 40 extra pounds, her back roared in protest.
"Ready, Paul?" she said. "Just to the next trees?" he asked.
Ahead lay a few hundred yards of dirt and scree cutting across open valley, utterly vulnerable.
"Exactly," she said. "You run and I'll be right behind you. Don't stop until you get there."
"Now?" Paul asked.
"Now," Josie said.
They ran, and Josie ran with one arm draped around Anna's bottom, her other arm feeling her way forward, ready to break their fall. She expected to fall. She'd never run carrying Anna like this, on a wet path strewn with loose rocks like this, with pain like this. Every step sent a sharp stab of steely light through Josie's spine and down her leg. Anna's weight was exacerbating whatever it was Josie had done to her back, but she couldn't slow down on the open ground. She had to catch up with Paul, who was suddenly moving with effortless speed and agility. Josie watched him leap and land, thrilling in his agility and courage. As if to punish her for her moment of pride, the sky ripped open end to end. Paul fell to the ground, and Josie dropped to her knee. No earthquake, no tornado could be that loud. Josie had lived almost 4 decades and had never heard a storm like this, had never known a sky this punitive. They rose and ran again and made it to the next forest. Josie followed Paul to a spot against a dead pine trunk. They sat side by side like soldiers in a foxhole, heaving. Anna was still attached to Josie's torso, her matted head in Josie's neck.
"You cold?" Paul asked her, nodding at Josie's bra, her mottled skin.
"I'm fine," Josie said. She was soaked with cold rain, and the cold wind was cutting through her as they rested, but she had felt warm while running. The pain, though, overwhelmed her senses.
"We're beating this," Josie said. "You see that, right?"
Paul nodded, serious in his acknowledgement, as if his mother was confirming something he'd begun to suspect and had hoped was true. They were moving, fully inhabiting the beautiful machinery of their physical selves, and they were outwitting the unthinking brute power of the storm. "We just have to get around that bend, I think," Josie said, pointing ahead. Paul took out his map and pointed to a wide arc his pen-drawn path made just before it reached the lake.
"I think we're close," he said.
A different kind of thunder overtook the air. It was as loud as the sky cracking they'd heard before, but this was coming from up the trail. It was more gradual, a growing roar, sounding like rocks, 1,000 rocks, moving together. Josie stood and looked up the bend of the trail. She saw nothing. Then a wave of dust came from behind a bulge in the cliffside. She had never heard or seen an avalanche, but she knew this was an avalanche, not 1,000 feet ahead. After the strangely orderly roar of it ended, the valley was quiet, as if resting after its exertion. Josie had no idea what to do. To retreat was impossible for all the reasons she'd arrived at earlier. The kids would suffer. It was too cold. They'd be soaked and frozen. But to go toward the avalanche?
"Was it, Mom?" Paul asked.
"What?" Josie asked.
Paul gave Josie a wide-eyed look, indicating that he didn't want to say the word avalanche in front of Anna.
"I think so," Josie said. In a rush, the rain seemed to double in volume. Each drop was heavy, distinct. Josie knew they had to move. She made a plan to make their way to the blind bend of the trail and at least peer around the corner to see what had happened, if there was still a path to follow. Again, she picked up Anna, whose grip around her neck was somehow tighter than before, painful but necessary, and she set off. She led this time, with Paul just behind. Far before the bend, they could see the evidence of the avalanche. A rough gray diagonal of rocks and scree obliterated the trail and had settled onto the valley floor hundreds of feet below. Josie looked up to the cliff face, looking for some clue about its intentions. Beyond the fallen rocks, she could see the path as it continued to what seemed like a clearing. Somehow, she and Paul and Anna would have to climb over the fallen rock for 50 yards or so and join the trail again, all the while facing the possibility that the rock would move again, that their traversing it would send it all downhill. Some impulse in her told her to do this quickly, to avoid rumination.
"Let's go," she said.
Her back wailed again, but she crawled up on the settled rocks, finding it almost impossible to gain traction. She raised a foot, put her body's weight over it, and immediately her foot slipped and she went down. Anna flew off and onto the dusty stones. Josie's hands braced her fall, but her forehead had struck a high standing stone. The pain was quick and severe, but Josie knew the injury was not great.
"You okay?" Paul asked.
He had appeared next to Josie and Anna, and given his light weight, he was able to move quickly atop the scree without sinking into it. Anna nodded, and Josie said she was fine.
"There's some blood on your face," Paul said to Josie. "Not that much."
Josie had no hands free to wipe it, and she knew that to make it across, Anna would have to crawl on her own.
"Follow Paul," she said, and Anna made no protest.
Favoring her unbandaged leg, Anna moved nimbly over the mass of loose rock, and Josie did her best to follow. She tried to make herself lighter, more agile.
"Wait!" she yelled.
The children were far ahead of her, finding this too easy. Josie was crawling, slipping, her limbs dropping through the surface as they would through newly fallen snow. An idea occurred to her, and she acted on it, knowing she had no choice but to try anything. She turned onto her back and pushed herself with her feet like a mechanic under a car. The scree scraped her back, her exposed neck, and the back of her head, but it worked. Her hands and legs had been concentrating too much weight on the loose rock and causing her to fall through it, but her back, acting like a snowshoe, was spreading her weight, and she moved this way across the expanse of fallen rock as her children watched and eventually encouraged her.
Almost there, Paul said.
Almost there,
Anna repeated. Josie had a strong sense that this image would stay with them, the picture of their mother backstroking across an avalanche in the middle of an Alaskan electrical storm. Josie snorted, and she laughed a loud laugh as the rain fell heavily upon her. When she was across, her children were waiting, Anna standing on one leg, holding her brother's shoulder for support. Paul's legs were raw and bleeding, his hands white with torn skin and the dust of the stones he'd crawled across. Anna's legs and hands were similarly aggrieved, and at some point she'd acquired a cut on her temple, a finger-sized red slash. Above, the thunder cracked again, as loud as any thunder had ever been since the birth of creation, and Josie laughed out loud again. It never ends, right? She said. One thing after another. Anna and Paul smiled, but seemed unsure exactly what their mother was talking about, and Josie was happy that the subtext of her statement had been lost on them. Okay, ready? She asked. She turned, expecting nothing, but now, on the other side of the avalanche, she could see it. The bright blue lake, no bigger than a swimming pool. Josie laughed again. Oh, God, she said. Look at it. It's so small. All this way for that. But it's so blue, Paul said. And look. Josie had been searching for the shelter the map had promised, but Paul had found it first. It was more than a shelter. It was a sturdy cabin made of logs and bricks, the straight line of its chimney standing like a beacon. On its door, there was the same sagging trio of balloons they'd seen on the trailhead sign. Josie didn't need to tell her children what to do. They had already begun running. Anna somehow strong again, and Paul sprinting ahead, knowing his sister would be fine, and Josie walked behind them, her shoulders shuddering with cold and a kind of tearless weeping. When she made it to the cabin, she saw the sign over the porch. Welcome Stromberg Family Reunion, it said. She opened the door to find Paul and Anna, soaked by rain and streaked in blood, standing amid what seemed to be a surprise party. There were balloons, streamers, a table overflowing with juices and sodas, chips, fruit, and a glorious chocolate cake under a plastic canopy. All around the cabin were framed photos from every era, most in black and white, all neatly labeled, the Strombergs through time. Josie could only assume that some intrepid member of the family had been to this cabin days ago, had set all this up for the family reunion, and then, for whatever reason, fire or unrelated tragedies, had canceled it all, leaving the cabin and all its bounty to another smaller family. Josie, Paul, and Anna, so tired. Who are the Strombergs? Paul asked. Today, we are the Strombergs, Josie said. There was enough firewood for 3 winters, and there was plenty of water, so Josie started a fire, and they took off their clothes and cleaned themselves and sat naked under a vast wool blanket as their filthy clothes dried before the fire. They ate and drank whatever they wanted in no particular order and were soon sated, and though their muscles ached and wounds roared for attention, they would not sleep for many hours. Every part of their being was awake. Their minds were screaming in triumph. Their arms and legs wanted more challenge, more conquest, more glory. That was good, right? Paul said. He didn't wait for an answer. He stared into the fire, his face aglow and seeming far younger than it was, perhaps reborn. His ice priest eyes had found a new and untroubled happiness. He knew it was good. Josie found herself smiling, knowing they had done what they could with what they had, and they had found joy and purpose in every footstep. They had made hysterical music, and they had faced formidable obstacles in this world, and had laughed, and had triumphed, and had bled freely, but were now naked together and warm, and the fire before them would not die. Josie looked at the bright, flaming faces of her children and knew this was exactly who and where they were supposed to be. Chapter 24. But then there is tomorrow. This is Rebecca Lohman. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Heroes of the Frontier by Dave Eggers. This program was directed by Jessica Kay, executive producer Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2016 by Dave Eggers. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.